Cold cases. An unfortunate reality that many police forces throughout the world must contend with. Usually, a cold case occurs when not enough evidence is collected to identify the cause of a case which, oftentimes, deals with murder, and they occur more often than one would think. In Tokyo, during a cold February night, Inspector Haru Takahashi was called in to investigate the death of Hikari Nakamura, a local poet of some fame. When he arrived at the Tanuki Inn, Takahashi had no idea what he was walking into. He thought it was another routine case involving a drug deal gone wrong or an overdose. But what awaited him in room 4D would haunt his dreams for the rest of his life. The first thing he noticed was the stench of sulfur lingering throughout the small room, then the smell of copper. It was dark in the room, the blinds closed. Takahashi had to turn on his flashlight in order to navigate better. His light revealed the blood-stained walls that were still dripping wet and the mess of overturned furniture throughout the entire room. And there, in the middle of it all, kneeled over by some strange symbol drawn in blood, was the naked corpse of Hikari. Her hands were clasped in prayer, her head bowed down. The corpse was so pale, it looked more like a mannequin than an actual body. When Takahashi neared the corpse, he quickly discovered that there wasn't an ounce of blood or dirt on it save for a frozen tear on the cheek. With a gloved hand, Takahashi carefully tried to collect the tear, but once his finger made contact with the corpse, the entire body shattered into pieces like Legos. I'm Agent Kai, and I've decided to make my reports for Laos in the form of a podcast. My hope is that you, dear listener, will discover the truth of this world and open your eyes to it. I met with Inspector Haru Takahashi in the lobby of the Bulgari Hotel. We were surrounded by several concerned patrons and staff who were all told to wait on the far end of the lobby. Takahashi was speaking with the hotel manager, Toro Sato, whose solemn face told a tale of concern. "Inspector Takahashi," I said in Japanese, "I'm at Mizo Kangetsu, military police." Takahashi nodded. "I'm glad you're here." He turned to Sato. "Sato-san, please excuse us." Sato bowed to us both and joined his staff on the far end of the lobby. "Mizo-san," Takahashi said, "I hope you have a strong stomach. What you're about to see defies comprehension. Rather than explaining it, I wanted to show you." He paused. "If you believe in God or Shintoism, then I strongly suggest you begin praying now." I followed Takahashi into the elevator. He pressed the sweet button. The elevator responded by taking us up in smooth, effortless motion. My superiors told me that this isn't the first victim found in what you call a frozen state. Is that right? I said. "Aye," Takahashi said. "This would be the 8th victim. The first was found 2 weeks ago. Hikari Nakamura, a poet. She was found in a motel by one of the cleaning crew." He rubbed his chin. "Mizo-san, I've seen a lot of fucked up shit in my time, but I've never seen something like this. It scares the hell out of me. Whatever's going on, I don't think it's natural." The elevator stopped and the doors opened. We walked down a corridor that led up to the Bulgari suite doors. "This, the 8th victim, is Akimitsu Kitagawa," Takahashi said. "Whoever or whatever is causing these deaths, discrimination is not given. People of all classes have been targeted." "Well then," I said, "let's take a look." The Bulgari suite was extravagant in decor and in size. It was more of an apartment than a hotel room, and the panoramic views of Tokyo were mesmerizing, especially with all the sights of the city lights. Therefore, The fact that all the walls of the suite were covered in blood was disturbing. The naked body of Kitagawa was placed on top of the dining table. The arms were spread wide and the head was facing up. From a certain angle, it appeared as if the body was about to go flying over the city as the body was positioned toward the large windows that overlooked Tokyo. I walked around the long dining table, examining the body. It was as white as a sheet of paper and clean, impeccable. There wasn't a drop of blood anywhere on or near the body, only a frozen tear on the cheek that glinted against the light of the room. All these facts were intriguing. However, what caught my attention was the way the body was positioned, torso upright, arms stretched wide and the head facing up. The body looked more like a marble statue giving itself up to a goddess or some kind of deity than a corpse. "What do you think, Mizo-san?" Takahashi said. "I can see why you wanted me to see this rather than explain it," I said. "It's rather disturbing." It's like the body is frozen, but it's not." Takahashi touched the body with a gloved hand. "Nothing happens if you touch the body itself. It feels warm like it's alive. But," he pointed to the frozen tear, "if you touch that tear there, the whole body shatters into pieces." "That's interesting," I said, taking notice of a strange symbol that the body was kneeling on. "The symbol." Takahashi nodded. "We don't know what it means. The only thing we've gathered is that there's a different symbol under each victim." "And do these victims have anything that connects them?" "None," Takahashi said. "It's like the victims are chosen at random." "Is that right?" "Follow me," Takahashi said. "You need to watch the footage of Kitagawa before whatever happened to him here happened." We made our way toward the hotel's security room. There, Takahashi had one of the security guards play the final moments of Kitagawa. He found the footage and with a shaky hand, pressed play. The footage began with Kitagawa walking into the hotel and making his way up toward his suite. All seemed normal until the elevator, same one we were on, arrived on his floor. Kitagawa stepped out and started for his room. However, the elevator doors remained open. Since there were no cameras that monitored the suite hall, at Kitagawa's request, it's not known what happened to make him come back to the elevator. When he did step back into the elevator, Kitagawa was making strange movements with his hands, almost as if he were trying to grab hold of something or keep something at bay. Once he stopped with the strange hand gestures, the elevator doors closed. Kitagawa spun around as if he was looking for something. A moment later, the elevator doors opened. Kitagawa approached the doors with caution. He peered out the doors, again checking for something or someone. Finally, he walked back out into the hall. A few seconds later, Kitagawa jumped back into the elevator, whose doors still didn't close, and began pressing all of the buttons in a panic. While doing this, he poked his head back out into the hall and was saying something. But he was turned away from the camera, making it impossible to know what he was saying. The elevator doors remained open. Kitagawa ran back out into the hall and never returned on camera. The elevator doors closed. "What do you think he was seeing or perhaps running away from?" Takahashi said. "That's difficult to say." A glance at the camera's timestamp. Date, 19th of February. Time, 22:25. How long between that timestamp and the discovery of Kitagawa's body? 2 weeks. What caused the search for Kitagawa? Takahashi turned to his phone for a moment. A missed business meeting. Kitagawa was a millionaire. He created some kind of AI that was going to revolutionize the world. And this meeting was the start of that. Also, according to his co-workers, the man was never late to a meeting in his life, let alone miss one. What kind of AI? I said. Takahashi referred to his phone's notes. Next, Ent. That was his company. Apparently, he was working on an artificial consciousness. Takahashi pocketed his phone. An AI with the ability to learn by itself. No data feed needed. He paused. You think someone wanted to take him out for it? I shook my head. I don't think so. You said that all the current victims have nothing in common. Takahashi nodded. Aye, nothing. All different from the next. Listen, can you do me a favor and send me a copy of all the information you and your team have gathered on these victims? Aye. Takahashi paused. Do you have any idea what we're dealing with here? I turned to the camera again. No, not yet. This is all very strange, Takahashi said. It's almost like the start of a plague or something. Takahashi wasn't too far from the truth. The next morning, I grabbed myself a coffee and began going over all the notes Takahashi and his team had gathered. I was staying in Janu Tokyo in the Janu Suite, courtesy of Patrice Landless. And like the suite Kitagawa had stayed in over at Bulgari, the suite I found myself in had panoramic windows that immersed you with Tokyo itself. After spending several hours going over Takahashi's team's paperwork, I found something of interest. While all the victims had nothing in common, they didn't even know each other, like Takahashi had said, there was something I found that linked them. Each of the victims had someone close to them via business. For example, the first victim, Hikari Nakamura, the poet, had an agent by the name of Tamo Ma. And Akimitsu Kitagawa, the millionaire, had an accountant named Mei Tamam. It was the same with all the other victims. To the unsuspecting investigator, all of these names had nothing in common. All these names belonged to people who were not related. But to an agent who was on the hunt for murderous yokai, these names, these people, were all one and the same. I called Cameron and informed him of my discovery. "I'll be damned, Kai," he said. "This yokai is a sneaky one for sure." "She's taunting us," I said. "All the aliases she chose are anagrams of her name. She knew we'd find her." "Right. And she's not afraid either. She's confident we can't stop her." "Exactly," I said. "I believe she's getting ready to make a big move." "What makes you say that?" I explained to Cameron that the victims all had careers ranging from the arts to the sciences. A quick Google search and all the victims revealed that each one was gifted in their fields. In a way, I told Cameron, Tamamu no Mei was absorbing the knowledge that these individuals had obtained during their lifetime. How she was doing this, however, I still didn't know. I'd have to examine the remaining body to see if there were any clues on it. "Christ, talk about strange," Cameron said. "And that's not a word I throw around." He paused and typed away. "What field hasn't Tamamu no Mei acquired yet?" I looked over my notes. "She doesn't have anything in prose."
"She's got poetry, Kai."
"Yes, she has verse," I said, "but not prose."
"So, she may be on the hunt again herself," Cameron said. "You think she'll strike soon? How many more will she kill?"
"One more," I said.
"One?"
"Tamamu no Mei is a kitsune," I said. "And what do we know about kitsune?"
"They're mischievous, murderous at times," Cameron said. "Bewitching and shapeshifting. Usually shapeshifts into beautiful women."
"Right, but in China, the kitsune is sometimes known as the juwehu, the nine-tailed fox."
"Implying what?"
"Well, this is just a hypothesis," I said. "But what if Tamamu no Mei was somehow using her nine tails to gather the knowledge needed to do whatever she's planning on doing?" Cameron remained silent for a moment.
"How'd you come up with that?"
"The symbols found with the eight victims," I said. At first, I didn't recognize what the symbols were or meant.
They weren't written in traditional Japanese, but rather kanji, and even then, the kanji was written in an old ancient medieval form, and their numbers.
I see, Cameron said. Numbers, perhaps signatures.
Exactly. If Tamamo no Mae has unleashed her tales, each one would sign its name to the victim, a spell sigil. That's how Tamamo no Mae could extract her victim's knowledge.
Naturally, Cameron said. If this hypothesis of yours is correct, then it would explain the positions and shattering of the victim's bodies.
Yes, that's right. The spell sigil would freeze the body in the position Tamamo no Mae's tails would put them in, and then the sigil would do its magic.
And once the information needed was extracted, the body would shatter.
Cameron, type some more.
Okay, Kai. You're going to need some proof. I'm working on that.
A kitsune, dear listener, is a mysterious yokai. While there exists lots of information on this creature, there are some things hidden from public knowledge. It is well known that kitsune's tails are powerful. On average, kitsune have multiple tails, usually up to 9. The more tails a kitsune has, the more power and wisdom they carry. However, it's a little known fact that some have the ability to give their tails life and transform them into a gang of Yokobuyo-gami, or pestilence spirits. For a kitsune like Tamamo no Mae, this wouldn't be a problem. In theory, she could detach her tails, transforming them into Yokobuyo-gami. These evil spirits would walk the world of mortals, invisible to all except for the well-trained and the victims. The 9 tails would take turns terrifying and killing their victims until their job was completed. Then, they would return to their master and regain their tail form. Of course, this was all speculation on my part. I could have been wrong. I could have misread the information before me. And I wish to God that was the case. But my gut told me otherwise. However, I should have listened more carefully. I should have been more patient. Later that afternoon, I made my way to the city morgue where Kitagawa's body was being kept and found Takahashi overcome by a cursing frenzy. What happened? I said. The body, damn it, Takahashi snarled. The only piece of whole evidence we had, now gone.
Gone? How?
Takahashi shook his head. I don't know. He rubbed his temples. The coroner was examining the body, making sure not to touch the tear, but after a few minutes, the coroner made an incision into the chest cavity and... Takahashi made an exploding gesture with his hands. Gone! The body is now in a million pieces. He slammed his fist into the wall. Other than that body, we have no leads, no nothing. This damn case is going to go cold again. The coroner, a young woman wearing a surgical mask, came out of the examining room. She had a name tag that read Shima.
I'm sorry, Inspector Takahashi, she said. It's impossible. The body fragmented into too many pieces. Putting it back together is not an option.
Takahashi cursed. I walked into the examining room. It was true. The body was nothing more than small, unrecognizable pieces of frozen human flesh.
And so our bodies shatter into infinitesimal specks of stardust, Shima said, to be blown by the wind high onto the clouds, to linger and fall into tomorrow anew.
Is that your prose? I said.
Shima shook her head. No, I wish. That's from the book Meet Me Tomorrow by Sakura Kawakami.
I don't believe I've had the pleasure of reading her work.
She's a new writer, and a good one in my opinion. Her novel just won the Akutagawa Prize. Shima chuckled. No AI used in her book. Her writing is all from the heart. You can feel it in her words.
I thanked Shima and rejoined Takahashi out in the hall. "Takahashi," I said, "we have a lead." Sakura Kawakami lived in the Kuni district just outside the town of Nakanojo in the Gunma prefecture. It was a gorgeous area surrounded by mountains and forests. The essence of nature ruled this area, and Sakura's house, a beautiful renovated ryokan, stood among pedicured lawns and gardens. We rang twice and waited several minutes before Sakura greeted us at the front door. "Sorry for the bother, Miss Kawakami," Takahashi said, "but we came here to, sorry," he chuckled, blushing. "We're investigating a series of crimes," I said, "and we are in need of your help." Takahashi was enamored with Sakura. It wasn't hard to see why. The woman was beautiful, a flawless pale complexion with long dark hair that accentuated her large brown eyes. She wore a white blouse with a long black slick cut dress. I couldn't help but notice her nails. They had a pristine manicure in different shades of red. However, her nails were quite long, not enough to attract attention, but longer and thicker than expected. Sakura welcomed us inside her home and served us tea after we discussed the particulars of the case, minus a few details here and there. "I'm sorry, but I don't know how I can help you," she said, crossing her legs, which caused her dress to fall back up her thigh. She quickly adjusted her dress. Takahashi's eyes were fixed on her thighs. "What can I do?" I handed Sakura a piece of paper with various anagrams of the name Tamamo no Me. "Do you have anyone who works for you," I said, "with any of those names or a variation of those names?" Sakura read through the list, using her long nails to guide her through the names. She shook her head. "No, I don't think so." Her eyes widened. "Wait, yes, I know Nomamata. She's my cleaning lady." "Is she here?" Takahashi said. Sakura shook her head. "No, she comes in the mornings." She paused. "She'll be here tomorrow morning." Takahashi turned to me. "This could be our break, Mizu. What do you think?" I nodded. "Miss Kawakami," Sakura smiled. "Please, Haru, call me Sakura." Takahashi blushed. "Sakura, I think it would be wise if we escort you into Tokyo and place you in protection." "Absolutely not," Sakura said, crossing her legs again. "I'm not one to run away from trouble. I'm staying right here." She smiled at Takahashi. "But you two can stay here and introduce yourselves to Noma tomorrow morning." "I don't think very well, Sakura," Takahashi interjected. "We shall do that." Sakura smiled. "Please, Haru, make yourself at home." I spent the rest of that afternoon and evening brushing up on my knowledge on the Yakubu Yogami. While I'd dealt with yokai in the past, I'd never dealt with a powerful one like Tamamo no Me. She was clever and dangerous beyond anything I had dealt with, and the fact that she was ancient didn't help. Her acquired knowledge and wisdom of this world was superior to mine or anyone. I knew that if I was going to stop her, I need to outsmart her in more ways than one. So far, she'd outsmarted me and everyone at Laios. She was playing us all like fiddles, using us to her advantage. Hell, she'd outsmarted the world. She'd gotten everyone to focus on counting their miseries rather than blessings. The more people dwelled on their misfortunes, the more powerful Tamamo no Me grew. According to Talku, Tamamo no Me was living in the past, present, and future simultaneously. In order to challenge her, he'd said, I would have to do the same and fight her in the past, present, and future at once. An impossible feat, or would have been, if not for Talku's regulator. I just hoped it would work and not destroy me in the process. As for Tamamonome's tails, or Yakubi Ogami, the Edo Samurai's talisman would do the trick. If I could trap the last living tail tomorrow morning, then I could use it to get to its mistress. I would be remiss, dear listener, if I didn't explain the Edo Samurai's talisman. You see, there's a legend that dates back to the Edo period of Japan. This would be around the 19th century, 1820, when fear of pestilent spirits was rampant. During this year, a gallant samurai managed to capture one of these evil spirits that entered his house. The spirit, in exchange for its freedom, made and signed a contract that it wouldn't harm the Edo samurai's family. News of this contract spread throughout Edo, Japan. The Edo samurai then instructed people to use the contract as a talisman to protect them from the Yokobi Ogami. My only concern now was Takahashi. He'd spent the whole afternoon and evening by Sakura's side. His swooning could be used against them with the Yakubi Ogami. If I wanted to protect Takahashi and Sakura, I would need to make sure they were both ready for tomorrow. I wandered throughout the spacious, renovated hotel for some time before making my way to Takahashi. I would have gone to him faster had it not been for a foul smell that I caught wind of while walking near the back of the place. It didn't take me long to find the source of the smell. The house had an open-air bath with a lovely pool of steaming water. Only this time, this open-air bath's waters had turned dark and murky due to the floating corpse that was decaying inside it. There was no question who the body belonged to. And once I recognized the face of the corpse, I ran back into the ryokan in search of Takahashi. It took several minutes to navigate through the large dwelling, but I ended up following the sounds of moaning and screaming until I reached a large bedroom. There was a low-lying bed where Sakura was on top of Takahashi, her naked body rocking back and forth. I could see Takahashi's legs and feet spasming violently. Sakura stopped and moaned loudly before she turned toward me. Her face was beautiful, except now it looked lifeless. Lower, her breasts were replaced by large white eyes with red pinpoint irises. Her abdomen was ripped open and tentacles filled with small teeth squirmed in all directions. When she stood up, I could see what was left of Takahashi. Sakura, or rather the ninth tail, the Yakubi Ogami, had devoured the top half of Haru Takahashi, bones and all. And despite the gruesome massacre, there wasn't a trace of blood. These tails didn't like to waste anything. "You perv," the ninth tail said through its mock mouth, while its tentacles squirmed in all directions. "You like to watch me fuck," it moaned as it walked toward me. "Come here, baby. I want you inside me." I pulled out the Edo Samurai's talisman, a paper made of fuda connected to a metal dart, and threw it at the ninth tail, but it missed as the tentacles flung it to the side. The ninth tail laughed. "Don't be nervous, honey. I'll make you feel so good that you won't even notice you're dying. Haru doesn't even know he's dead." The ninth tail began doing something between a laugh and a roar. I reached into my coat pockets and pulled out several talismans. The ninth tail dodged all of my attacks. Then it lunged toward me, but I sidestepped out of the way and ran toward the other end of the room, leaping over the bottom half of Takahashi's remains. I then waited for the demon to come toward me, threw another talisman, and started running around the room. I kept running in circles, throwing several of the slips of paper until the whole room was covered in the talismans. The ninth tail snarled, "Nuff!" It shot out its tentacles with lightning speed and wrapped them around me. Then, it pulled me toward it until Sakura's face was in front of mine. "Kiss me," it said. "With pleasure," I said, pulling out the final talisman I had tucked underneath my sleeve. Before the mock lips could touch mine, I staked the final talisman into Sakura's forehead. Within seconds, the whole room lit up with the hundreds of paper-thin talismans writing. All the lights shot onto the ninth tail, cutting and recutting its tentacles until it could no longer regenerate and was forced down onto the ground. Once I was freed of its grip and caught my breath, I ordered it to summon its master or face death. It refused my order, but with each refusal, the lights got brighter and the ninth tail's body started to crack. With each crack of its frame, the beast roared. "Last chance," I said. "Summon Tamamo no Mei, or you will die here." Reluctantly, the ninth tail acquiesced and summoned its master. By doing so, the ninth tail abandoned the human form it had taken on and reverted back to a fluffy white tail that rested on the wooden floor, lifeless. Then, it slid across the room and was back on Tamamo no Mei. "Kai, you are a nuisance," she said, walking out of the darkness. "But I understand why you keep interfering with my plans. It's human nature to defend yourself." Moonlight seeping in from the room's window glowed upon Tamamo no Mei. Her complexion was radiant, and her hazel eyes were mesmerizing. She resembled a porcelain figure. "Let's stop fighting," she said, caressing my face. "I don't want to fight you." She smiled and kissed me. "You taste delicious. Kai, join me. Be my king."
"You have no king, Mei," I said. She chuckled.
"Yes, you're right." She ran her index finger under my chin. "Women have ruled in the shadows long enough. Men have played and failed."
She leaned into me.
"I will correct what's wrong in the world."
"I don't disagree," I said. "And if you could do so without the bloodshed of the innocent, then I'd be inclined to support you. But you don't believe in such a thing."
Tamamo no Mei scoffed. "The innocent? There are no innocents in this world, Kai. Only savages and monsters live here. You know this better than anyone else. Why you think there are innocents is beyond me."
She removed her elegant robe, revealing her naked frame, smooth milky white skin, and 9 long and bushy tails.
"These 9 tails of mine tell you that I am over 900 years old. I know this world better than anyone."
"Then why rage war?" I said. "Why suffocate humanity?"
"Humanity is a plague," she said. "It shouldn't even exist. Even you, Kai, are controlled by it. You see my naked frame, my breasts, my curves, my thighs, my legs, and your blood boils." She smiled. "If your mind wasn't so strong, you'd give in to your baser instincts and, like a dog, you'd try to have your way with me."
I remained silent.
"You know I'm right, Kai," she said. "But that's what I like about you. You know your limitations and you strive to push past them."
She pressed her body against mine.
"If humanity was more mentally disciplined, if it tried like you try, then maybe I could reason."
She pushed me away. "But men are despicable, disgusting, and dirty creatures who want to hump everything without giving a fucking consequence." "Not all, Mei, but too many," she said.
"I believed once that this world was capable of change, that love between two could transcend the horrors of this fucked up shithole humanity calls the world. And every time I tried to believe, I was proven wrong."
"I understand," I said. "You have been treated wrong. So many in this world have. but even those that have been treated wrong continue to push forward, to strive in this world. Mere fantasy. Tamamo no Me walked toward the large window and peered up at the large moon. I really wish things were different, Kai. She turned and looked at me, a few tears running down her cheek. Maybe, just maybe, if I'd met you centuries ago, we could have been happy. This world may not have been so cruel. Tamamo no Me fanned out her tails and within the blink of an eye, transformed herself into a beautiful white fox. She leapt up to the windowsill. I'm sorry, Kai, she said, but I will punish this world and watch it burn in my fire. And I will laugh as mankind burns and I dance in their ashes. With that, Tamamo no Me jumped out the window and vanished into the dark wilderness. In the hours that followed, the MAU performed a clean sweep of Sakura Kawakami's house. All traces of Haru Takahashi's presence at the Ryokan were erased. As far as anyone was concerned, the decorated inspector disappeared from the face of the earth, and later would be presumed by many to have been killed by a mysterious murderer who the inspector got too close to. Sakura Kawakami's body was cleaned and placed on her bed. When the bustle of the day would begin, the world would come to know that one of Japan's newest and talented writers had been lost, taken from this world by a murderer who never was and would never be. And as the hours of night gave way to the day, this agent returned to his hotel room in Tokyo and made his final preparations to go after Tamamo no Me. While she ran off, the tracker this agent had planted on her person gave up her location. Therefore, this agent had more homework to do on this Kitsune if he were to stand any chance of defeating her in the past, present, and future. Although, this agent admitted, going after such a hurt and defeated yokai weighed heavy on his conscience. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Macbeth, after a long life of bloodshed and violence, reflects upon the world and concludes that this world is farcical and devoid of any real meaning. The world in which we inhabit is a brutal place, filled with much hurt and pain. And throughout the centuries where human life has endured, many have suffered under the weight of powerful men and women. Nothing has changed. Many still suffer from such things. One can't help but wonder when positive change will occur. Many may have given up hope in such a thing. Others fight every day to make such a positive change happen. But in the end, humanity is at the mercy of fate. Or perhaps humanity is at the mercy of its own hand. If so, the question posited here is, which hand will humanity raise? The blood-soaked hand or the open-palmed hand? Unlike Macbeth or Tamamo no Me, this agent wants to believe that meaning does exist in this world, that humanity can change to cold, dark earth, and that one fine day, the sun will rise and greet the earth with warmth and radiance.